Welcome to Sky Women. I'm your host, Dr. Carolyn Moyers, a wife, mom, and board-certified OB-GYN. This is a place to educate, empower, and inspire. Join us each week as we share the power of women's stories. Real women, real stories, real inspiration. Put on your stretchy pants. Let's get going. Welcome, Sky community. Welcome back to another episode of Sky Women Podcast. We are so happy to have you with us today. We have a very special guest, Dr. Avram Blooming, who is the author, co-author of Estrogen Matters, which he wrote with Carol Tavris. Welcome, Dr. Blooming.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. It's so exciting to have you. Your book, Estrogen Matters, is one of those that I could not put down. I read it like a textbook, and I have been using that information as I'm counseling patients and recommending the book to my patients who are resistant to the idea and need some more data to make informed decisions. So first of all, could you just kind of tell us your background and how you and Dr. Tavris came about writing this book?
Absolutely. I'm a medical oncologist. I've practiced oncology for close to 50 years. About 60% of my practice were patients with breast cancer. And although the prognosis of breast cancer was guarded 30, 40 years ago, and it's still not 100% curable, but about 90% of women with newly diagnosed breast cancer are cured. Sure. That means it never comes back during the course of their lives. Now, that's not 100%, and it's not to be taken lightly, but it should be understood in perspective.
Absolutely. That's remarkable.
I treated many women for breast cancer. Often, I used chemotherapy to treat them when they had slightly more advanced breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And I found that women were complaining to me of many of the symptoms that I generated by putting them into premature menopause.
Sure.
And my reaction was sympathetic because I'm a physician, but also what I was thinking is, suck it up. I treated your breast cancer. The likelihood is that you're cured. Deal with it.
You were thinking, at least you don't have breast cancer. I mean, come on, let's put it in perspective.
Exactly right. But
and she's thinking her quality of life sucks. Like, exactly, thank you very much. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
Then my wife got breast cancer when she was 45. Mm. And I treated her with chemotherapy. And she did very well. And she went into premature menopause.
Right.
And my wife, who is very smart and is not a complainer at all, tolerated the hot flushes, the difficulty sleeping, the heart palpitations, the night sweats, and didn't complain to me at all. Wow. And then she found that she was having great difficulty concentrating, which to her was a terrible curse, to the mm-hmm. point where this prodigious reader was unable to remember what she read two pages back. Mm-hmm. And that was intolerable.
Sure.
And I started investigating this, even though I am male, intensely.
Yeah.
And what I found,
it became personal.
Very personal. Mm-hmm. And what I found is that menopause doesn't last a year or two. It lasts a median of 7.4 years. That hot flushes and night sweats are the things we hear about most, but mm-hmm. there are 34 different symptoms, right, including palpitations, which I mentioned, and dry mouth, dry vaginal mucosa, painful sexual intercourse, loss of libido. There are many symptoms, and while it lasts 7.4 years on median, for women of color, it often lasts longer than 10 years.
Right.
This isn't just something you have to suck up. This is a very real quality of life problem that has to be faced and dealt with. And I wasn't doing that.
Right.
And so I started looking at the reasons why estrogen shouldn't be given to women who survived breast cancer. And the obvious red flag was, come on, estrogen causes breast cancer. And especially in 2002, when the Women's Health Initiative first published their first report, it brought the walls of hormone replacement therapy crashing down. What this $1 billion study, the most expensive study ever underwritten by the United States government, concluded is that hormone replacement therapy increases the risk of heart disease, increases the risk of death, increases the risk of breast cancer, increases the risk of stroke, and prescriptions fell from about 44% of eligible women to less than 5%, where it remains today. And so many of the conclusions of the Women's Health Initiative have been walked back, but not publicized.
Right.
So that, for example, what they reported, I told you the first report came out in 2002, well, less than 2 years later, they reported that hormone replacement therapy has no effect on quality of life. And the first question one has to ask is, what planet are you living on? And when you look at the study, Carolyn, what you find is this was a prospective randomized study. And the investigators knew that if symptomatic women were randomized to a placebo, to a sugar pill, they would know within a week whether they were on hormones or not, and they would drop out of the study. So they intentionally did not admit symptomatic women to the study. What they reported, incredibly, and what was headlined in the New York Times, is these women who had no symptoms had no improvement in the symptoms they didn't have when they were given hormones. Well, if you read the article carefully, but most people don't, certainly most lay people don't, What you find is about 13% of the women, 13% had symptoms. And no surprise, those women had significant improvement. The Women's Health Initiative has now published a variety of articles, all stating that the single best treatment for the symptoms of menopause is hormone replacement therapy.
Yes, yes. Yet, decades of women have been undertreated. Decades of physicians have been undertaught. So we have this perfect storm of women feeling dismissed in the healthcare system, leaving untreated. I think the stats are 70% of women who seek treatment leave untreated. And so this is very frustrating. Women feel confused because of the misinformation out there.
Let the FDA released a report within the last 2 years saying that of 84% of women who went to physicians with complaints related to menopausal symptoms, less than 5% were treated.
Oh,
that's disgraceful.
It's disgraceful.
Yes. So let's talk. You started this interview by saying women are confused. Join the club. Everybody is confused. Women, their relatives, physicians, and as you point out, since the majority of OBGYN fellowships, the majority don't devote any time to menopausal treatment, it's no surprise that many physicians get their information from the same headlines that patients get their information from. And that has to be changed.
Absolutely.
The Women's Health Initiative has now walked back every single bad thing they wrote, with one exception, so that they said initially that it increases the risk of heart disease. Well, actually, no, it decreases the risk of heart disease. They now say, as long as it started within 10 years of a woman's last menstrual period. Well, the overwhelming majority of women who start hormones start it within 10 years, much earlier than that, of their last menstrual period. They said it increased the risk of strokes. Now, with 20 years of follow-up, they have walked that back. They acknowledge that it decreases the risk of hip fracture, which is associated with as many deaths in the United States each year as breast cancer. And hormone replacement therapy decreases the risk of hip fracture by about 50%. They've also said it does not increase the risk of breast cancer death. And by the way, which you know, estrogen alone was found to decrease the risk of breast cancer by a significant 23% and decrease the risk of death from breast cancer by 40%. Now, those statements that I've just reviewed are not in contention. We all agree with that. The public doesn't get that information, but we all agree with that.
Right.
Except the FDA that put a black box warning on estrogen shortly after the Women's Health Initiative was released in 2002, based largely on the incorrect statement that people assumed estrogen increases the risk of breast cancer. It does not. And that black box warning still exists today on every product containing estrogen marketed in this country.
Even vaginal estrogen, our local therapy.
Right.
So I love in the book when you outline, you kind of debunk the myth about estrogen causing breast cancer, because we would expect then to see more incidence of breast cancer in premenopausal women, yet we see more in postmenopausal women when we don't have any estrogen on board. And you use the example of looking at the data of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer, comparing them, those who are on hormone therapy, to those who are not, and those who are on hormone therapy actually fare better. Can you speak to that?
Yes. First, I think it's important in this discussion, because people are confused, and what we're trying to do is promote understanding.
Right.
One warning is if you come across somebody who knows the absolute truth regarding hormone replacement therapy and breast cancer, run away. Nobody knows the absolute truth. We all have to be open-minded. We have to make decisions based on the best available data, which we are accumulating all the time. Mm-hmm. So that when you and I have this conversation, we're talking with the best available data.
At this moment in 2023.
Correct. Right. Right. And I answer many questions with, I don't know. And the reason I do is because I don't know final answers, but I'm reasonably certain of the answers I have so far. So I think, and I'm sure your listeners know this, but let's go over very quickly, that hormone replacement therapy refers to the use of one or two drugs. One drug is estrogen, which is the backbone of hormone replacement therapy, and that's what we'll spend most of our time talking about. But women who have a uterus have an increased risk of uterine cancer if they take estrogen alone.
Correct.
And progesterone reduces that increased risk back to baseline, so that women who don't have a uterus can be given estrogen alone as hormone replacement therapy, but women who have a uterus are generally given estrogen with a form of progesterone. Okay. And the one remaining conclusion that the Women's Health Initiative is holding on to, the one that we disagree on, is they say, yes, we now know that estrogen decreases the risk of breast cancer, that women who are diagnosed with breast cancer while on estrogen have a better prognosis than women who are diagnosed not taking estrogen. But what we found in the Women's Health Initiative is the women who were randomized to the combination of estrogen and progesterone have an increased risk of breast cancer development. Not an increased risk of breast cancer death, but an increased risk of breast cancer development. And what I've written, what we review in the book, there's an article that I'm publishing in somewhere between October and December of this year that shows that the data that the Women's Health Initiative is using to reach the conclusion that the combination increases the risk of breast cancer is misinterpreted. Their data don't show even that.
Fascinating.
Yes.
I'm thinking of a quote from an old attending who said, there's lies and statistics. You know, so data certainly can be manipulated. You have to look at it with a very careful eye. And to the layperson, it's all so incredibly confusing. So I appreciate you kind of laying that out for us.
If somebody says, well, I listened to this podcast, and what did he mean this misinterpreted? Mm-hmm. I will explain it in two sentences, but the reason I wrote an article is two sentences don't really give you a chance to give a thorough explanation. When you do a prospective randomized trial, you are comparing the patients who are given the test substance, in this case, both estrogen and progesterone, with patients who are given either nothing or a sugar pill or a placebo pill. And in order for you to say that the combination medicine that you gave increases the risk of breast cancer, you have to find the increased risk among the people who got the pill compared to the people who got the placebo. Well, interestingly, I told you that estrogen alone actually decreases the risk of breast cancer. And when you look at the graph that they show for estrogen alone, you look at the graph showing the risk and superimpose on it the risk for people who got combination estrogen and progesterone, it's the same risk. They are superimposable. Well, how is that possible? Well, it's possible because the conclusion is based on a comparison between the people who got the medicine and the people who got the placebo. And in the case of the combination, there was a lower incidence of breast cancer among the women who got the placebo. So the difference wasn't due to an increase in risk from the combination. It was due to a decrease in risk among women who got the placebo. If you compare the combination against women in the estrogen-only study who got the placebo, there's no increased risk even with the combination. And so the question is, well, wait a minute. Why is there a decreased risk among women who got the sugar pill? Mm-hmm. Well, what they found, although they didn't report it, is the women, some of the women who were randomized to get the sugar pill had taken estrogen before they entered the study, for years before they entered the study. And we just finished saying that estrogen alone has been shown to decrease the risk of breast cancer. If you eliminate those women who took estrogen before entering the study, the increased risk disappears because then the placebo group risk is what was expected. And so the way to understand that is women who start hormones around the time of perimenopause and therefore didn't take it before that have no increased risk of breast cancer development, even if they took the combination. And that's about 90%, you know this better than I, of women who are approaching menopause.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we also should mention that the average age of women in the WHI was 64, significantly older than those who are initiating therapy. So
generalizing that to the general population was another error that they now acknowledge, but didn't acknowledge at the time.
Correct. So what are some ways that healthcare professionals can address the misinformation and help improve health literacy around hormone therapy. And one way is reading your book. I mean, you're doing a fabulous job by being present on social media, writing this book, getting the information out there. What are your suggestions? For instance, I recently gave a lecture at a university around this topic, and internal medicine, family medicine, this is their worst nightmare, dealing with menopause and menopause therapy. And they have a lot of questions around it. And, you know, when you pull residents, it's like 20% who are even comfortable having a conversation around menopause. So what are your suggestions for us healthcare providers so that we are better taking care of these individuals who, so that they're not leaving untreated?
If you're going to take care of people with a problem, educate yourself about the problem. Mm-hmm. Don't practice medicine by headline. We wrote the book for women. And I obviously write articles for the medical community. And so Carol and I wrote the book for women, but we referenced the book the way we would reference a medical article. So right. If you bring the book to your physician and the physician says, first of all, I don't have time to read the book. Second, why should I believe some doctor in Southern California over what I think is true? The answer is don't believe the doctor in Southern California. Read the book when you have time and look at the references. And if you can find references that can make a strong case against what the book is saying, fine. But Carolyn, they won't. And I didn't write the book because I am in the employ of a drug company and I'm looking to market something. And right. Carol and I never have and don't have any relation with any pharmaceutical company that has a pro or con stance on this. We wrote the book to educate both the medical and the lay public about this very important issue.
Yeah, 100%. Women who start experiencing this collection of symptoms, as you mentioned, you know, most commonly we hear about hot flushes and night sweats and insomnia and vaginal dryness and palpitations and joint pain and loss of sexual desire. A lot of times they are just poo-pooed. You know, it's like, you're fine. We've done your labs. Everything looks fine. You're fine. Like, it's all in your head. That's the how they leave the office feeling like they're told it's all in their head and they're incredibly frustrated. I don't have a problem with you not knowing how to treat menopause, but please send them to a menopause provider. That's my beef. It's fine if you don't know how to treat them, but validate their experience and that it could be perimenopause or menopause and send them to a menopause provider.
And that's, as you know, why the North American Menopause Society has a website where you can access the website. And by zip code, they will give you the name of OBGYN like yourself who are educated in the treatment of menopause. The other half to the answer is it's not just physician education, it's patient education. And that's yes. Why we wrote the book for patients. You know, when mastectomy was the treatment of choice based on male physicians, of breast cancer, women simply signed a form saying, I recognize that the doctor is going to biopsy my breast and doesn't know what he'll find, and usually he, and if he finds breast cancer, he will remove the breast. And when women wrote books and finally said things like, I'm not going to sign this form, doctor. If you find breast cancer, you wake me up. And let's have a discussion about the best way to deal with this. And only then am I comfortable having you proceed with definitive surgery. It's going to require that kind of stance by women saying, I'm not going to be poo-pooed. I'm not going to be given a tranquilizer and a sleeping pill and told by you, doctor, that this subject is not open to discussion. This subject is very open to discussion. And I'm not leaving here until we discuss it so that you give me the respect of the person who's party to this decision.
Yeah. I feel like that's a mic drop. Absolutely. Yes. As we, like your book is doing, helping women to educate themselves so that they can advocate for themselves and be a part of that decision-making and really insist that their voices are heard. So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about what are the actual risks associated with these unregulated bioidentical hormones from compounding pharmacies that patients tend to believe are safer in some way.
We live in a capitalist society. When the Women's Health Initiative came out, the drug that was being used as estrogen, the drug which now after 20 years of follow-up has been reported to decrease the risk of breast cancer by 23% and decrease the risk of death from breast cancer by 40%, was the drug Premarin, which the Women's Health Initiative used. Premarin is an acronym for pregnant mare urine. I've had doctors say to me, well, it tastes like urine. Who would want to taste it? So that I actually had to take one and bite into it. And now it doesn't taste like urine, but I didn't swallow. And so people saw a marketing opportunity. And the marketing opportunity, well, sure, they said, taking pregnant mare urine pills isn't good for you. But if we give you something we are labeling as bioidentical, that must be safer. What it doesn't say is we have data showing that it is safer. That must be safer. And bioidentical is such an appealing buzzword. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out that bioidentical is largely estradiol, which is the most highest concentration of estrogen in a premenopausal woman's body. And calling it bioidentical doesn't mean they really did intense identity studies. Actually, most of what's called bioidentical estrogen comes from yams, and women really aren't yams. The bioidentical market has grown explosively, so that as a result of that form of advertising, at least 40%, and it's probably larger, of all hormone prescriptions, estrogen prescriptions for women are bioidentical. And I have no objection against that. I recognize the motivation was commercial, not scientific, but I have no objection to that, as long as it is an FDA-approved commercial preparation.
Yes.
In your question, you inserted the word compounded. Mm-hmm. And what that means is you go to a doctor's office and the doctor says to you, dear, I'm going to give you medicine that is customized to your specific need. And I'm going to examine the estrogen level in your saliva or your urine or in your hair follicle. And mm-hmm. I will write a prescription that specifically addresses your need. That's flimflam.
Yeah.
That's inappropriate.
And that's red flag. Run for the hills.
You bet. And the problem with compounded bioidentical hormones, which in rare situations, like in women who may have allergies to something in the medicine, it may be appropriate. But for the overwhelming majority of people, it's just a way of getting money out of them. And it's done by local pharmacies, many of which are licensed local compounding pharmacies and do wonderful work. But compounded bioidentical estrogen does not have any FDA supervision. And the few studies that have been done have shown markedly different levels of estrogen in these preparations. So you're taking a drug that simply isn't regulated and therefore potentially dangerous and shouldn't be given.
Couldn't agree more. You said it very eloquently. Thank you for clarifying that. So now I want to shift gears and talk about cardiovascular risk. And I love how you made it so simple for me to even understand. I was like, finally, somebody's explained it to me well about how estrogen actually is beneficial to our cardiovascular endothelia and the benefit of estrogen to our heart health.
As you use the word endothelial tissue, which is the cells that line blood vessels. And estrogen, just the way it preserves elasticity and distensibility in muscles, does it in the cells that line blood vessels so that blood vessels can expand and not get stuck in at a certain diameter and get narrower and narrower, which happens to all of us as we age. Estrogen doesn't completely prevent it. You don't live forever if you take estrogen, but it makes it less likely that you will suffer a cardiac event. How much less likely? By 50%. Estrogen will reduce the risk of serious heart disease by 50% because of its effect on blood vessels. And what most people don't know is statins are widely given to men who have elevated circulating lipids or fats in their blood, and they can decrease the risk of heart attacks in men who are so affected. They're also given to women, except they have no benefit when they're given to women who have no history of heart disease. That doesn't matter. It's a very profitable market, and so it is given to women. Estrogen is much more effective in preventing heart events than statins are, even though statins are widely used and estrogens are frowned on.
I tend to defer to their internal medicine, their primary care physician, whenever we have issue with, you know, adverse lipid profile. But I have a lot of women who are resistant to taking statins. And so this is very valuable information.
Now, remember I said for primary prevention, this is women with no history of heart disease. Women
with
no history of heart disease, now secondary prevention, statins may be of benefit. But it's important to understand the difference and not simply assume statins are good, estrogen is bad. That's not true. And one of the points that keeps coming up in this kind of discussion, Carolyn, is women are not treated fairly in the medical environment. Most studies are done on males and extrapolated to females. And when I say most studies, I mean even studies on male mice, that females have not been part of the routine studies of drug effectiveness and disease prevention. And women aren't just almost males. They are different, thank goodness, creatures and should be treated that way. You know this from the history of your specialty. I mean, endometriosis was women coming into doctors and saying, we have these terrible pains. They are incapacitating associated with other symptoms. Well, endometriosis, which is cells from the uterine lining that are now in the peritoneal cavity and bleeding sometimes into the peritoneal cavity, are unique to women. Men don't get that. And so for many years, these women with stomach pain were called hysterical. Well, interestingly, the hysteri prefix, as in hysterectomy, refers to the uterus. And it was thought that the pain was due to a uterus that wanders all over the female's abdominal cavity and causes this pain. Well, never mind, that's crazy. It's also completely inaccurate. And it wasn't until some doctors, I assume females too, said, wait a minute, there's really something going on here. And they found endometriosis is a very real condition that warrants very real treatment.
Well, and even today, it on average 10 years before receiving a proper diagnosis. I mean, so to your point, yes, women are treated unfairly within the medical system. And it's incredibly frustrating for women of all ages in many regards, as you allude to with endometriosis as well.
But how wonderful that there are people like you and even some males who are joining in this campaign to give women the respect and the care that they deserve.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for that. Let's switch gears and talk about dementia. We cannot leave our discussion today, Dr. Blooming, without talking about the concern for cognitive impairment and dementia and any protective effects that might be there with estrogen.
Well, if there's one diagnosis that frightens women even more than breast cancer, which we've just discussed seems to be a false red flag, it's Alzheimer's disease or some form of cognitive decline.
Yes.
And what people will tell you is, and this is true, there is no prospective double randomized study of cognitive decline and benefit from hormones. That's true. There never will be. There is no way we could do a study, since cognitive decline, normal versus pathological, is hard to differentiate. It would be a study that would take way too long and cost an astronomical amount of money. And so we have to get data from non-randomized studies. And what we know is that estrogen increases dendritic connections in the brain. Dendritic connections are the connections between nerve cells. And estrogen is constantly inducing more dendritic connections in the brain. And in animals, often male, but some female, this actually increases the ability to learn new tasks, to remember old tasks. It appears from the data we can collect, not prospective randomized studies, that estrogen does decrease the risk of cognitive decline. And in the studies we reference in the book, the decrease ranges from somewhere around 25% to as high as 65%. I believe it's real. We are all prejudiced by our individual experiences. I can tell you, and we have to be careful not to generalize from that, but I can't help noticing that my wife started hormones because she had trouble remembering a page she read two pages back. Mm-hmm. Her memory, that was when she was 45. She's now 80. And her memory is terrific, and she remembers books. It's much better than mine. Of course, I'm not on estrogen. And that particular symptom is gone.
Yeah, amazing. So I think a lot of women would hear this and say, yes, but I've been diagnosed with breast cancer. Can I use hormone therapy?
Okay, that question leads into another statement that we have to make, which is you and I are having this discussion where we're exchanging information that we both want to make available both to the lay and the medical community. But we are not giving advice to any specific patient. This is not an M&M. I like M&Ms, but it can't be dispensed as if there's absolutely no problem with it.
Right.
Women with breast cancer, I told you I got into this field because I'm an oncologist, and I treated many women with breast cancer. And so back in 1992, when I started looking at the data, I was surprised by the absence of data showing that giving hormones to women with a history of breast cancer increased the risk of recurrence. And so I published an article last year, May, June issue of the Cancer Journal, that is called Hormone Replacement Therapy After Breast Cancer, It Is Time, published in the Cancer Journal. And what I did is I reviewed 25 studies, which were all the studies I could find in the medical literature in languages that I could understand. There are now 26 that looked at what happens to women who had breast cancer who go back on hormone replacement therapy. Of the 25, now 26 studies that I reviewed, 24 showed no increased risk of recurrence. 24. And it didn't matter whether the hormone was estrogen receptor positive or not. It didn't matter whether the patient had a BRCA gene mutation that was associated with an increased family history of breast cancer. 24 of the 25 showed no detriment vis-a-vis breast cancer. 5 of the studies were prospectively randomized, and 4 of those 5 showed no increased risk of breast cancer recurrence. 1 study showed an increased risk of breast cancer recurrence. That study has the acronym HABITS. HABITS stands for Hormones After Breast Cancer, Is It Safe? And that study from Sweden showed an increased risk of breast cancer, 1 out of 25. Well, did it show an increased risk of death from breast cancer? No. Did it show an increased risk of distant metastases from breast cancer? No. It showed an increased risk of either local or contralateral recurrence, meaning a localized tumor in either the treated breast or the other breast. And that was treated was not associated with an increased risk of death, even after prolonged follow-up. The problem with that study is that prospective randomized study did not require baseline mammograms before women were admitted to the study.
Oops.
Yeah. How could you not do baseline mammograms?
Right. It could have already been there.
And the only thing they found is local recurrence. And So I've been in contact with the senior author, who is a wonderful man. I called him and asked him if he could update the study. The last follow-up was published in 2008. And he said to me, well, he's left this field, that he's now working in prostate cancer. Well, good. Mm-hmm. Prostate cancer is important, but this is the only study that is quoted by people who use it to prevent the administration of hormones, and asked him to see what he could do. And he promised me he would have some of his graduate students to update it. Well, if you read my article, I've updated all the other studies, and I still haven't found an update of this particular study. The other thing I did is I reviewed the papers that summarized the findings of the studies, like I did, looking to see if they could do an analysis and get some majority opinion. And what I found is there were 20 reviews of the literature before the one I published. Mine is the most recent and also the most extensive. And in those articles, the only study that they report that found an increased risk of recurrence is the same Swedish study. Mm-hmm. They do report that 1 or 2 of the other studies found an increased risk of recurrence, and they're wrong. They are misquoting those studies, but there in the medical literature, it suggests that other studies found the same thing. And that's the information that many doctors will read and convey this negative result to their patient.
So this is, I think that women who hear this and have a family member who has breast cancer or personally have had breast cancer, their minds are going to be blown right now. And I don't think it's any secret. You shared in the book that you presented this information to your daughter who also had breast cancer. Am I getting that correct? And then she got to make the choice and she's like a little confused, like, Dad, you usually tell me what to do. And it sounds like you're giving me an option here. So will you speak to that briefly?
Sure. When my wife's decision to go on hormones was her decision, not my decision. My daughter developed breast cancer. I told you my wife developed it at age 45. My daughter developed it at age 36. Oh. That early family history strongly suggests some inherited mutation that leads to an increased risk of breast cancer. As you might imagine, every possible mutation has been checked. Yes. And there's something there, but we just don't know enough to find it. My daughter, when she reached menopause, asked me about that, and her mother was on hormones. And what I told her and what you read correctly is I can't tell her what to do. I can give her the information, and we talk a lot. So she knew a lot of this information. Mm-hmm. But I sat down and we went over it. And she said, what should I do? And I said, I can't make that decision for you. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That I wouldn't offer this as an option if I thought it was dangerous, but I don't know. And she has to make that decision for herself. She did. She's now been on hormones for 6 years. She's now 53. She feels terrific. She's doing very well, works out in the gym all the time, and so far is fine.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for your time today. You have been a wealth of knowledge and you presented in such a palatable way that I think that the audience will really appreciate your answers to these questions, and as well as your personal experience. I mean, knowing that you're a medical oncologist whose wife had breast cancer and has gone on therapy, whose daughter made the decision to go on and is thriving. Like, I think that this is really exciting. Not only that you've presented us with all of the data driven, but you know, that personal piece makes a difference as well. And I just can't thank you enough. I encourage everyone to go follow Estrogen_Matters on social media and pick up the book by Dr. Blooming and Dr. Tabras. Perfect. Yes. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, Carolyn. Thank you.
Yes. Until next week, be well. All right, Sky community. Thank you for listening to another episode. This episode was sponsored by Sky Women's Health. As a reminder, we're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and we help relieve back pain and pelvic pain in pregnancy and beyond. If you are pregnant and having pain and you feel like you have no reliable way to relieve it, look us up at skywomenshealth.com, request an appointment, and we'll call to get you scheduled. As a board-certified OB-GYN with a neuromusculoskeletal medicine fellowship, I help you realign with hands-on drug-free treatment and relieve pain on the spot without medication. We'll help you maintain these results through your pregnancy and postpartum period. Every pregnant person deserves this, and we are so excited to serve you. You can find us on our website, as mentioned, or on social at Sky Women's Health, or you can call the office at 817-915-9803. That's it for today. Until next week, be well.